From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made at a press conference where a young soccer coach was soaking in the spotlight. Nathan Shelley is the new coach of the top-ranked West Ham United team. He became known as the, quote, wonder kid, albeit accidentally, after his coaching skills brought victory to his former team. During this press conference, he's cleverly fielding questions from reporters. Later, his boss gives him a car. He seems to be on top of the world with the Hammers. But is he? The reporters, Nate's social media followers, don't see him dealing with the imposter syndrome that he's feeling, or pressure from his family. How easy it is for a text from his mom or dad to turn his mood, or him wondering, how does he actually handle the players? How does he show who he truly is? He doesn't look happy to us. Our connection's also made with the happy-go-lucky coach of Nate's former team. Ted Lasso is an American football coach who, despite being out of his element with professional, well, football. I was going to say British football. It's football. It's soccer. It's football. But he's earned the respect and friendship of colleagues and players, even though he's no soccer expert. But is he really happy? He is far from home and with his son living with his mother, Ted's ex, in Kansas City. And while he's open about his mental health challenges and is working with a therapist, Ted still has panic attacks and struggles to confront internal stressors. Of course, we're talking about the fictional characters from the Apple TV show Ted Lasso. The show is known for having a center of kindness and camaraderie and optimism, but also deeper and more profound questions. Season 3 kicked off this week, and it explores the theme of happiness and success and what happens when you find that success that you think you've always wanted. When we go after what we want and then we get it, sometimes we're not as happy as we thought we'd be. Why is that? What do we think will make us happy versus what actually makes most people happy? We're going to explore that question and the themes of the storytelling of that show this hour. And if you haven't seen the series or haven't seen the new episodes, there will be some spoilers in the discussion. Not too many, I don't think. I've only seen episode 1 of the new season, and we've got no toad venom on this show. Just a conversation about Ted Lasso. But it's not about Ted Lasso, too. It's about happiness. It's about good storytelling. It's about what makes this thing work. Hannah Davis is with us in studio, the founding director of Flower City Folk and a professor of practice in RIT School of Individualized Study. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
By the way, tell us what Flower City Folk is.
Flower City Folk is Monroe County's folk life service organization. We support all kinds of people who are engaged in a whole variety of creative endeavors. So any kind of kind of communally relevant artistic practice, crafts, music, you name it, we do it.
And at RIT, tell us about what you do there.
I'm a professor of practice, as you said, so I teach classes about folklife to students. This semester I'm kind of teaching Intro to American Studies, so we discuss all kinds of local politics, culture. Again, it's pretty broad, but it's wonderful because I get to introduce lots of locally relevant content to students from elsewhere.
Great stuff. Well, thank you for being here, Hannah. And our thanks to Jim Allen on the line with us, an associate professor of psychology at SUNY Geneseo and author of The Psychology of Happiness in the Modern World, A Social Psychological Approach. And I think, Jim, a fan of Ted Lasso as well. Is that right?
Yes, it is. Thanks, Evan.
It's good to have you.
Yeah, I am.
It's good to have you back here. Hannah Davis, a fan of Ted Lasso?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Hannah happens to be married to the only British man I've ever met who has no soccer skills, no football skills. Actually, I don't even know if he does.
They're not as good as his other athletic skills.
Rugby, perhaps?
Yes.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, the short legs come in the way.
There you go. So, Jim, I'm going to start with you on this here. First of all, in general, what do you think has made a show like Ted Lasso work at this particular time?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think you have to take into consideration the pandemic and a show that focuses on optimism and kindness probably has an appeal during that period of time. And the show contrasts with so much else that's in the media that's less positive. I think people are looking for those kind of messages.
Do you think the show over time has gotten a little syrupy sweet, or do you think it's kept its edge, Jim?
Well, I don't know if I'm unbiased, but I think it's kept its edge, and the development of Ted and his panic attacks and so forth is really interesting. And you know, certainly he never seems to run out of funny things to say, aphorisms and so forth that are, you know, just seem classic. So, yeah.
Enjoy, I guess I'm curious to know why you yourself enjoy it. We're talking sort of about why you think it works right now, but what do you love about it, Jim?
Well, the message of kindness and optimism, I think, are really great. And that's something that positive psychology, the psychology of happiness, demonstrates really clearly that helps people be happy. People that are able to practice optimism, able to practice kindness, are happier. Another thing that I like about the show is that most of the characters are intrinsically motivated. They don't seem to be, for most of the main characters, don't seem to be interested in fame and fortune for their own sake. Ted Lasso in particular talks about it's not about winning. You know, it's about the relationships. And I think that's a really important message that's often missed in our culture. You know, the people seem focused on their relationships with other people and intrinsic motivations rather than, fame, you know, like I said, fame and fortune.
Hannah, what works about the show for you?
The deeply likable characters. It's not a perfect show, like I just said to you, but, you know, I'm not here to pick it apart. The thing that draws me into it is the individual characters. And there are a few exceptions, of course. There's some nasty people along the way that are important to the plot. But Hannah Waddingham's character, for example, lovely, charming, good costuming. You know, it's a fun show and it's likable.
And when it comes to likable characters, this is an interesting debate. I grew up with a father who always says, like, don't recommend a movie to me if there's no likable characters. I don't want to watch it.
Uh-huh.
And now what I often hear from people who are in content creation is like, no, you can have entire franchises where you don't have likable characters, but if it's compelling, people will watch. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's true. We love to hate things. people love to have things that they can have some kind of righteous reaction to. That feels good as a viewer and as a person. So, yeah, that can be just as engaging, but I think it is refreshing, and perhaps especially because of COVID, to just to root for the good guy and to have these nice kind of storylines be pulled together.
When I first was aware that the show was gaining popularity and my brother was calling me saying, have you watched the show? Have you watched this yet? I was like, no, I saw the NBC ads years ago, and NBC picked up premiership rights, and they did these little ads with a Ted Lasso character just as a promotional vehicle. I thought, that's fun for like 12 seconds. It's the thinnest premise in the world. It can go nowhere. I feel like even the Ted character has got more depth than I would have thought at first. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. He's more than a mustache. He is likable, but he is, as Jim mentioned, you know, he struggles with mental health and kind of opens up about it over the course of the last two seasons. And I assume that'll be an ongoing plot point. He's real, you know, and that's engaging too.
Hannah is so modest, but like part of the reason we called her is like she's has all this, I think, interesting perspective and expertise on how we tell stories and why certain stories kind of stick in cultures and what works and what kind of translates across boundaries. And I mean, I don't think there's a Ted Lasso probably parallel in the folklore world, but I do wonder if you're surprised at all that a show like this that doesn't have an overarching edge of violence, meanness, you know, yes, there's villains, but like, it doesn't have what has made a lot of modern media successful. Any surprise there?
No, I don't think so. And, you know, I did kind of exclude why you invited me. You asked me to tell people what I did. As a folklorist, I do think about storytelling and narrative structure quite a lot, and people's kind of everyday experiences and how those might fit into familiar narrative structures. So that's what I'm thinking about here today. No, I don't think it's surprising that this is popular. You know, there is something charming and bucolic about about Brits to Americans, for sure.
which I mean, you married one.
I did. It worked on me like a real sucker. But there is something charming. You know, we've embraced things like a Great British Bake Off, Antiques Roadshow. I'm thinking about these very bucolic kind of exceptionally English shows that probably in some way created some kind of cultural context for this. And we see lots of kind of cute street scenes that feel like those shows in Ted Lasso. Beyond that, we have shows like Schitt's Creek and The Good Place.
I think we can say that on the air. Rob? You should. I know it's the proper name, and it's. I'm going to say it for the censors.
Very sorry.
S-C-H-I-T-T. Actually, Stephen Colbert and CBS, every time Colbert brought up the name of that show, they would put the name in the full letters on the screen so people saw, okay, I'm pronouncing it this way, but it's just a proper name. I mean, okay, but so
I should have spelled it.
I hope I have done my job. Continue. Go ahead.
I'll pay the fine.
The Creek Show.
Yes, The Creek Show. We have shows like this that have popped up along the last, maybe within the last 5-10 years. That, again, have very likable characters with very realistic kind of everyday challenges that I think people find engaging. So when we put that in the context of these kind of bucolic settings and we get this kind of cutesy appeal, I think it goes really well, understandably. It's just nice. And when we balance the niceness with some realism, I think that registers with people in a unique kind of way.
Yeah, I'm thinking, Hannah, about just how unusual it feels with The Creek Show that you mentioned, with Ted Lasso, where it's not that like niceness always wins or it's real pat, it's always easy, but that you can have edge like Roy Kent, but still be kind. As gruff as he is a teddy bear and he has a good heart and he cares about the people around him. He's not just a narcissist. He's not just a wrecking ball. He's not just a caricature of profanity. And so I find that refreshing because my sort of goofy approach to life, we were just debating this with the Little League coaches recently. It's like, yeah, there's Bobby Knights of the world who throw chairs and choke players. And I guess there are players who will now say that he's the best thing that ever happened to them, that he got a lot out of them, and that they never would have performed at the high level if not for his brutal sort of approach and tough love coaching. But I just don't believe that that's the only way to get the best out of people. And I don't believe that that's the only way to win things. And I don't know if that kind of comes off as like saccharine or whatever, but that's why it works on me. And this is probably where you tell me I'm like a sucker. No,
not at all. No, and as a Hoosier, I have very critical ideas.
Oh, geez, I didn't even know.
Yeah, yikes.
Are you a Bobby Knight fan?
No, God, no.
Okay. But probably a lot of Hoosiers are, right?
Absolutely, yeah. So, and that's interesting. And I, Jake and I last night were...
Jake is her husband.
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, Jake, the actual football expert who's not here today. Jake and I were talking about about Nate's character on the show. Kind of following a rough pattern in the way that Jose Mourinho did in his own career, who is also well known for being a little spicy, let's say, not loved by all, and very harsh towards players and playing favorites and being kind of nasty to mixed results, sometimes very good, sometimes very bad, right? I do think people are maybe a little bit tired of that. I think increasingly as we become aware of the challenges, if we're talking about athletic kind of context, if we're thinking about the challenges that athletes face in their own careers, if we think about the ramifications of that kind of behavior towards somebody who's working in a professional context, if we think about the toll that takes, just that kind of treatment takes on anyone's mental health, I think we have increasingly little room for that kind of behavior. And I know that's not true for everybody, but I think when we're talking about this kind of broad cultural context, we are more open-minded about the nice, fuzzy, warm stuff.
I agree. Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, if I can interject, one thing that strikes me is that Ted Lasso is such an unusual character, and interesting what Hannah thinks about this from a folklore perspective, because when you look at who football coaches actually are, they're not Ted Lasso. You know, I think of Nick Saban, for example, and I have to admit here, I'm biased because I'm an Auburn graduate, not an Alabama graduate. So, you know, you know, can you imagine a football coach who doesn't care about winning? And in the episode last night that dropped, can you imagine a football coach who takes his team down in the sewer for a pep talk? He's not a real character. I think that really is worth talking about. The people that are successful in sports, the coaches, are not at all people like Ted Lasso. And the people that are successful as corporate CEOs show up with a significant degree of psychopathic kinds of tendencies. So, you know, Ted Lasso, although we love him, he doesn't represent the real world. You know, I think that's worth discussing.
We're going to talk about the Nate character coming up, which Hannah brought up. But before we do that, and I'm really curious to get Jim's take on the question of why so many people, and Nate's a fictional character, but you get what you think you want, and then you end up miserable. What's going on there?
Yeah.
But first, let me grab a phone call in Rochester. Is this Jim? Joel? Jim? Who's on the phone here?
Hey, it's Joel.
Oh, Joel. Hi, Joel. Go ahead.
I wanted to mention two things. For about the last 25 years, I've had conversations with my students in colleges and universities about this very issue. And there are two things I wanted to mention. The first is about kindness. My students are always shocked when I mention to them that, you know, when the Dalai Lama was asked about his religion, his response was not that he was a Tibetan Buddhist, but that he was kindness was his one true religion. And he repeats that often. But the other thing is about the issue of happiness. And from that, I want to pull up a more local comment. And this is from Paul Burgett, the longtime dean of students and also vice president at the University of Rochester. And I'm going to read a little bit of what he said about happiness. He said, quote, "Seek out satisfaction in life rather than happiness. No one can be happy all of the time. Indeed, life never affords us anyone that luxury. Satisfaction, on the other hand, is the real barometer of your quality of life. It is having enough. It is to leave the dinner table full, but not painfully so." He then later said, quote, "Life is too complex to reduce its objective to something like happiness, because life has pain, it has sorrow, it has disappointment, it has failure, and none of us is immune to any of those things. Happiness is like a butterfly. A butterfly flutters around me and occasionally will treat me by landing on my shoulder, but I can't own it. Happiness, whatever that word means, is not a constant," close quote.
That's Paul Burgett?
So, that's Paul Burgett.
Oh, the great Paul Burgett, yeah.
He said it, you know, multiple times. He would talk about happiness quite often, and it made me think quite a bit when I was getting a divorce, and both my soon-to-be ex-wife and I were standing in front of a judge, and the judge kept going on and on and on about our daughter and how, you know, we would want our daughter to go to college and become this and that. And I, you know, wanted to kind of interject and say, no, actually, I just want my daughter to be kind. And I don't care if she stays home or if she raises a family or if she, you know, marries a woman, or I don't care what she does. You know, what's key for me is that she's kind, and kind to humans and animals and so forth. So those are my two cents for whatever they're worth, and maybe they can add something to this conversation, which is deeply needed. So thank you.
They're worth a lot, brother. That's great stuff. That's beautiful, Joel. First of all, I'm really glad I'm always glad for anybody invoking the late, great Paul Burgett. We miss you, Paul. A beautiful quote there. And the general sentiment, Joel, I mean, you know, I agree with you there. I tell my son every night, just be kind to everyone you meet and be generous and be thankful for everything you have. And that's the core of what I hope for him. That's pretty much it. If those things happen, the rest will probably take care of itself. But let me turn to Jim. There's a lot there on happiness and the notion of the overemphasis of happiness or happiness like something that we could possess and hold as opposed to experience amidst an array of important and worthwhile emotions. What do you think, Jim?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of wisdom there, and I appreciate the quote. I wasn't aware of that quote. One of the things that the research finds that limits people's happiness is their expectations are too high. And, you know, life is difficult sometimes, and we've got to expect that there are going to be some roadblocks. We also can't monitor our happiness really closely. We have to live in the moment. We have to, just kind of give up on the close monitoring of it. And that's really important. And I think reflected in that quote there. Another thing is that when researchers talk about happiness, what they most often are really talking about is life satisfaction. They're talking about how satisfied people feel like how their life is going. And I think that quote captures that emphasis on life satisfaction rather than happiness. And then one other additional thought, and I'll stop and see where you want to go with the conversation, is that there's something called affective forecasting errors. And affect is a fancy term for emotion. And what this means is that people aren't usually good at predicting what's going to make them happy or unhappy. We make predictable mistakes with that. And I think that's something that's really worth talking about. I don't know if you want to go into that in any detail or not.
No, I would. I mean, the one thing that I wanted to make sure that I also understood from your perspective as well is the difference between happiness and contentment, Jim.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So usually when we talk about happiness, we think about kind of joy and those kinds of positive emotions, and contentment is more of a satisfaction. Contentment can be an emotional response, but generally when researchers are studying so-called happiness, they're looking at a cognitive appraisal, a thoughtful appraisal of how well their life is going, which can be different from this emotional feeling of contentment. It's certainly all important, and that feeling of contentment is a great indicator. Mm-hmm.
I want to ask our listeners if you want to weigh in on any of these subjects, on happiness, what success means, why we chase it so hard, why it doesn't always make us happy, and then how you feel about the storytelling in Ted Lasso, which has inspired this conversation. The season 3 launched this week, and the show is back. It's 844-295-TALK. If you want to talk about any of these subjects, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program, connections@WXXI.org. I think it was in The Atlantic, a pretty good review that I was reading. And I say a good review. I've only seen one episode of the new season. But I mean a good review in that it was a very thoughtful approach to understanding the dynamics that the show has created going into season 3 here. And the author was saying that, number one, the team coached by Ted Lasso, Richmond, right? It's rich. It's fictional. You would know this, Hannah. Right. It's fictional. It is fictional, right? There's not a Richmond.
As far as I'm aware.
But West Ham, very real.
You have to check with Ron.
Very real and very evil. Very real and very evil, West
Ham.
So Richmond gets promoted to the premiership at the end of last season. That's what they wanted. That's what they were playing so hard for. And in Europe, of course, there's relegation and promotion. And so they get to move up to the top league in England. And that's what that's what they were. Their fans wanted. That's what the players wanted. That's what the owners wanted. And what we find at the beginning of this season is everyone's sort of miserable. They're all freaked out about having a bad season and getting dropped back down instead of appreciating the moment of success and appreciating where they are. The players are getting harassed by fans on the street who are already worried that they're going to get relegated again. And everyone is sort of on edge. People are not dealing with conflict well. And then, meanwhile, a former assistant coach of Ted Lasso, you got Nate. Young Nate has been hired to coach West Ham, and of course it's what he wanted. He wanted to be recognized last season for his genius, for his contributions. Part of it, of course, were parental issues. His parents were very hard on him. He's working to please them. So he thinks if he can get this top job at one of the top clubs in the world, that his parents will respect him more and might love him more, and that he might be happier. And instead, we find out 10 minutes into the first episode. He is miserable too. He's kind of he's got obvious imposter syndrome because he's acting like the jerk that he probably really isn't inside because he thinks he has to. He's nervous about how to handle a press conference. It doesn't go very well. He's upset with seeing how his counterpart handles his press conference. Nobody's happy. It's like you all got what you wanted. That's my summary, Hannah. How would you
it's absolutely,
it?
Yeah.
Is that pretty good?
Yeah, all the predictions put Richmond in 20th place, and Nate gets a dig in at them, in on them at one point by saying, well, they're in 20th place because there's no 21st place.
it's a good line.
It is a good line. He's full of good lines. And we, you know, the same kind of pattern is repeated by Keeley, who I think is played by Juno Temple. I think that's right. Keeley, who
She's got her own agency.
Yeah, she's finally broken away and she has her own marketing agency and has, you know, a real office with real employees. And she has this fancy window that she can turn on and off to obscure her own office. And she's miserable too. She's so stressed and she's sad. She's scheduled crying time into her workday so that she can, you know, purge some negative emotions. She's not doing well. Nobody's doing well.
Yeah, we find one of the main couples is breaking up.
Yes.
I'm not trying to give too much away. And they're very loving about how they're talking about it. And maybe we'll find out more in the episodes to come about why. But they seem to care about each other, but they're both so busy that they just don't have time for the relationship. It's like, Jim, what's going on here? Why is it that we strive so hard and we finally get to the top of the mountain, we look around and go, boy, it kind of stinks up here. What's going on there, Jim?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think part of it is this effect of forecasting errors. We're not really good at predicting what's going to make us happy in the long term, and there's some interesting reasons for why that happens. The other thing that happens is that people undervalue the importance of relationships. It's what I tell my students is the single most important predictor probably of well-being, contentment, happiness, life satisfaction is just feeling like you have safe and secure and rewarding relationships. The other thing is Nate in particular being torn by so many external pressures and trying to meet the expectations of other people. And that's really caustic to happiness. People that are content, happy, have high life satisfaction, tend to be intrinsically motivated, and they're meeting their own goals rather than goals that are dictated to them by other people and by society. So I think there are a lot of things like that are going on.
And let me just ask you before I get back to, so Lisa on the phone, I'll take your call. Got a good comment from Karen. A lot of really interesting thoughts about these subjects. But Jim, just is there, from your understanding of the research of happiness, everybody's different and what rings someone's bell is not the same as the next person. But is there a general approach to thinking about how we view success and how we view our own sort of well-being that could put us on a better path to report ourselves as happy, that doesn't set us up for disappointment if we get what we think we want?
Yeah, I think there is. And some of the things, like I'd mentioned before, is not, you know, we need to have reasonable expectations, realize that we're not going to be happy all the time. We have to avoid monitoring our happiness on a moment-to-moment basis. We have to live in the moment. And we have to think about what's intrinsically motivating to us. What do we want? And not what other people want from us. And that includes people like parents and sometimes spouses or siblings or other family members. But it also includes the society as a whole. The society as a whole tells us that fame and fortune make us happy. But when we're basing our happiness on comparisons to other people, that just doesn't work. That's an extrinsic motivation. So again, we've got to do things that are intrinsically motivating and intrinsically satisfying as much as we can. And then, you know, come back to social relationships. It's really largely about social relationships. And, you know, those of us who are fortunate to have those secure and nurturing social relationships are the people that are the happiest.
How's that work for you, Hannah?
Applying.
There's a lot of wisdom there, isn't there?
There's a lot. Applying what Jim has discussed is a whole other
thing,
right?
If only it were
right?
so easy.
I know. Yeah. I'd like to, I'd kind of like to jump back to another thing that Jim mentioned, if that's all right. This idea that Ted is not a realistic character. He's not a realistic coach. Mm. And the same is true for many of these characters, right? But I'm wondering...
Or he's not a commonly sort of...
Well, right. Right.
I want to believe he's like that's yes, realistically plausible. I want to believe that.
Right. And well, that's what I'd like to ask about is this idea of belief. You know, we, you know, as viewers of a sitcom are expected to engage in some suspension of disbelief. We enjoy this show even though we know that Ted is probably not a realistic coach, right? And that some of these players are perhaps not realistic, et cetera. And I'm wondering, you know, do we engage in that same kind of suspension of disbelief in our own life when we're thinking about mm-hmm. achieving happiness and how to find fulfillment? Do we tell ourselves, is this why we're not good at choosing things that will make us happy and content? Do we suspend our own disbelief?
Well, choose is an interesting word.
Yeah,
because,
I guess it is.
You know, because I'm not like so sort of Pollyanna that I think, well, you can always just choose to be happy. But I do think yeah. there's a lot there when it comes to how do you try in the midst of a struggle to grab onto some perspective. Let's right. say you're looking sure. to buy a house. Let's say, it, yep. which is a really privileged thing to do.
Yes.
But it's also filled with stress.
Yeah.
And can be filled with disappointment. And it can be filled with, you know, a feeling that you might be getting taken to the cleaners. Mm-hmm. So how do you balance those? Is this a fair question? What do you think?
It is. Yeah. Evan's digging yeah. deep today. He knows he knows perfectly well what I'm dealing with.
I bring it up, yes. Hannah, because Hannah and I were talking yes. off air, but I've been there myself.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so it is very easy
right.
to, and I don't think the stress, like, I think the stress is still real. Like, that's not like a...
Absolutely.
I'm yeah. not saying like, well, how could you be stressed about something that you should feel privileged about?
Right.
But how can you find the balance that says, okay, the stress is realistic. It's okay.
Right.
But I'm going to try to gain a little bit of distance from this and say,
right.
there's a lot of people who would love to have my stress. You know what I mean?
Right. Totally. Yeah. And you're absolutely right. I mean, we, of course, do not, you know, we don't get to pick and choose to be happy. That's not how these things work, right? But we are nevertheless expected to make decisions and, you know, choose to do particular things that we know will affect our, you know, kind of overall outcome, you know.
I have to kick it to Jim to see what he thinks about
yeah.
this. And then what
yeah.
we'll do is we'll take our only break and then I'm going to take Lisa's call and we're going to get a lot of listener feedback. But go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, a really good point. I appreciate that, Hannah. You know, to some extent, we can choose to be happy. There are what's referred to as positive activities like practicing gratitude, practicing kindness, trying to be optimistic, that we can really choose to do and scientifically, empirically will increase our happiness. I blanch a little bit when people are saying that this is a 100% cure-all. You know, I think of a single mother with 3 children and no job and telling her to feel gratitude. But I think for a lot of people, you know, choosing to engage in these activities can be really, really beneficial and can help us. And psychologists also talk about construal, the way we view the world as being so important. And just an example, I have a dear friend who has stage 4 lung cancer. And I remember sitting on his patio this summer and him saying, this beer I've got has to be always at least half full. And, you know, in the glass half full kind of perspective, you know, when he's going through something like that ability to find some humor, some positive in bad circumstances is certainly a really, you know, really powerful thing. And, you know, and then just finally, I mentioned Ted Lasso, you know, maybe not being like real football coaches. You know, I'd like to bring up the point that maybe we could engineer the world so that it was different, so that we would have more Ted Lassos coaching at Auburn or Indiana or Alabama.
Little League.
Yeah.
I bring it up because that's the world I'm in now, but I see plenty of people.
Here I understand.
I bring it because I see plenty of people who I'm going, I don't understand your approach here.
Yeah.
These kids are not going to be pros. They're maybe 9. Can we be loving?
I remember that very well.
Yeah. But I also know some people view it differently. Some people feel like if I go hard at these kids, I get the Bobby Knight effect. The Hoosier in the studio says, go with the former, not the latter. This is going to be our only break of the hour. We're going to come back with Hannah Davis, founding director of Flower City Folk and professor of practice in RIT School of Individualized Study. Jim Allen is a professor of psychology at SUNY Geneseo, author of The Psychology of Happiness in the Modern World, a Social Psychological Approach. All of us Ted Lasso fans, for the varied reasons you've heard, and the show is back this week with a focus on whether the success we think we want truly makes us content or happy, and how that impacts our daily lives here. So we're right back with them, and we'll get your phone calls on the other side of this break. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections. Do you need a break from all the heavy things that we've been thinking about in the world? If all of Rochester wrote the same song, brought songwriters out once again this year, bringing their best take at the same song title, and you're going to hear some of the versions, and I think we'll have a good time on Friday on Connections. This is Connections, and look at you guys. You blew up the phones, so let me take some phone calls. Lisa in Rochester has been waiting. Hi, Lisa. Go ahead.
Hi there. So I love Ted Lasso. One of the things, just one, that just sort of sustains me through this is that it reflects what my dad always said, and that was, when you're faced with someone that is just all out of sorts and attacking you or negative or whatever, to remember that whatever they say or direct at you is about them. It's not about you. Mm. And I think that, in that sense, you gain objectivity. So that's like a present day lesson. It's not focused on your goal or your goal for being successful, but more on the journey.
That's really good, Lisa. And not only is, I think that's a great overall point, I think it's even more salient in the modern age where we feel like we have to respond on social media or someone's wrong or someone's calling us out and we've got to dunk back on somebody, and it's going to feel so good to just dunk on somebody. And so what we see in Ted Lasso's first episode of the new season is his former colleague Nate is over at West Ham, and in Nate's first press conference, Nate is absolutely tearing into Ted and Ted's team. He is mocking them. He calls Ted a bad coach, using a more colorful term. And, it's downright mean. But Nate is sort of cosplaying the tough guy coach that he thinks the owner of the team wants him to be. And so how does Ted respond? Well, the owner of Ted's team wants him to fight back. It's kind of a proxy battle with her ex, and she wants Ted to go throw some punches at the press conference too. But Ted does it his own way. He basically says, they're like, well, what do you think? This coach said that you're awful. And he's like, hey, he's funny. He had some good lines in there, and he always had good lines. He's a good guy. He's a good, smart coach. If you don't give that oxygen to that fire, it's amazing what happens to it. But I fall victim to this all the time. It's easy for me to sit here with a microphone and be like, well, here's how you should do it. I am stepping on that rake all the time. And the rare occasions when I avoid the rake, I usually find myself feeling better. But it's tough, Jim, not to want to punch back or to take the high road. And I'm sure there's moments where you not taking the high road is better or is important for some various reasons. But a lot of the time in this kind of age that we're in, we could probably just do away with not getting into these nasty back and forths or not responding to every time we think we've been insulted or showing grace. It's tough, though. What do you think, Jim?
Yeah, absolutely. And I've been there right there with you, Evan. It's a hard tendency to resist. But there's actually really good empirical research looking at revenge, and revenge is not nearly as satisfying as we anticipate it to be. Mm-hmm. And it's part of this affective forecasting kind of thing that I mentioned earlier. In fact, it's not satisfying at all. And the reason seems to be is it keeps us caught in that moment of conflict and anger and so forth that we tend to dwell on that even longer. And our well-being is just generally better suited by letting it go, you know, moving on with it. But again, it's hard for us to understand that. We don't anticipate that.
Yeah, the most recent president, who's not Joe Biden, said that revenge is essentially the drawing force of his life. But what Jim is telling us is not only it's not something good to pursue, but even when you get it, you don't feel good as you want.
Well phrased. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. I appreciate that, Karen. By the way, are you good at avoiding social media, Spats? Because
no,
you get drawn into it too. You have no wisdom to offer on this.
No, I've got nothing. As the youngest and probably, I assume, least emotionally mature in the room at any given point in time. No, I love an argument. I think, you know, taking the high road is often easier said than done. It requires a level of, emotional maturity and wisdom that is hard to tap into, even if you have it. And it feels really good to, get some feelings out. And we're all guilty of it. But it is one of those things I think you have to learn the hard way. I guess I'll take this opportunity to apologize to people I argue with on Twitter.
I've been trying to do less of that because it just doesn't do any good for – nothing changes in the world except for I get more surly and I've wasted more time.
Yes.
You know? But today, a very strange thing happened today. I noticed a PhD and a researcher writing on Twitter about some new evidence about the impact of – people who are not vaccinated against COVID versus people with mRNA vaccines on autoimmunity. So what his initial tweet, he said, so here's some news. mRNA does not spur autoimmunity as much as people who are unvaccinated and get COVID and recover. And my first read of that as a layperson, I was like, darn, I have an mRNA vaccine. So then I'm reading through the thread and it comes up that, like, he doesn't mean you're less immune. He means you're less prone to a negative autoimmune response within your body. But I just read the word autoimmunity as like, oh, well, that's what we want, right? No, we want immunity, but we don't want autoimmunity. And I didn't know that. So I simply like waited. And I was like, hey, you might want to clarify this for people in the lay public like me, because otherwise they might get the opposite impression of what you're saying about mRNA. And he was like, do you not have Google? And I was like, wait a second, man. I'm not like coming in just throwing grenades here. I'm trying to help. Like skill I have in life is communicating and understand how people talk to each other. And I think you can do this a little more effectively. And he's like, if you do not have a dictionary or Google, it's not my problem. It was like that kind of thing. And I was like, now you're looking down your nose at the lay public, man. Like, try not to. And he's like, well, if you didn't get it from the outset, you're not my audience. And I'm like, then why are you on social? So I told him was like, look, I literally typed this out. I said, I respect you. I'm grateful for your work. I'm simply helping you see that if you're kind of looking down your nose at the lay public, they might actually get the wrong information. And that's not what you want either. And he blocked me. I'm blocked by this guy.
Classic.
He's probably a really nice person, right? But he's probably so used to, in social media, any dissent being nasty and immediately just filled with this venom, this toad venom, Rob. But I don't think, there you go. Look at, that's a Ted Lasso reference. But I wasn't intending to do it. I just think social media predisposes us to think that everything is this fight. So I got nowhere with it. And I just learned again, Hannah, don't even try. Get off there. I don't know, Jim, is there new research on Twitter? It's not good for us, right? Come on.
Yeah, social media, again, largely because of social comparisons and what you're talking about, it just brings out the worst in us. I admire your perspective of seeing how this person is a good guy, probably a nice guy. But, you know, it's hard to see that for most of us, myself included, when we get in a spat like that. It's really unfortunate.
Yeah, it's a bummer. It's but PSA. Research says mRNAs, still good. Okay. Andrew in Rochester is next on the phone. Hi, Andrew. Go ahead.
Yeah, I bring it back to some of the conversations that we had or that were had on stress and
yeah.
kind of goal setting. You know, so one thing you reminded me of a Jim Carrey quote that you probably have heard. He says, "I wish everyone could get rich and famous and everything they ever dreamed, so if they see it's not the answer." So like figuring out what we need to actually focus on, because you know oftentimes it's those more superficial things that we are chasing that don't end up bringing us happiness. And there's the longest running study I've been going for several decades at Harvard on happiness. Actually, JFK was in the original cohort when he was a student there, but they also had some local Cambridge students or Cambridge young people who didn't have the privilege of Harvard students to, you know, kind of get the whole spectrum. And one of the researchers that was on that talked about how he said happiness equals love, full stop. So not just romantic love, of course, but companionate love and relationships. And a lot of that research is some of the research you see now that says, you know, like not having close friends can be as and loneliness can be as bad as, you know, smoking cigarettes mm-hmm. and things like that. But then I wanted to connect as well to you're talking about stress. And there's actually there's a lot of research, a book actually I highly recommend called The Upside of Stress, that started from this curious research study that showed that people who had high levels of stress, it was correlated with people who had high levels of meaning in life. So, you know, when you're chasing after big, audacious goals, there will be some stress. But what they were able to show was that when you reframe the stress that you're having to connect to a long-term meaningful goal, that the negative impacts of stress on your, you know, the physiological level are greatly reduced. And so one more quote, I guess, from Viktor Frankl says that happiness can't be pursued. It has to ensue as the unintended side effect of personal dedication to a cause greater than oneself. So
that's good.
Kind of connecting that purpose in.
That is really good stuff. Andrew, thank you. Jim, what do you make of that?
Yeah, the comment about social relationships is really important, and that's a great study. There's a book for popular audiences out now by those authors that I highly recommend. The thing about stress reminds me of flow states, FLOW, and so folks may have heard about. So we're doing something we're intrinsically interested in, and the challenge is right at the peak of our skill level. So we can do it, but it takes a lot of concentration, a lot of effort. And these things are happiness inducing, but they are stressful. So the idea of stress being a benefit, you know, it depends on how we frame it. It depends on whether we feel like it's within our skill level, and so forth, but it's a really good point. And finally, the Viktor Frankl quote is really, really important. Research seems to show, though, that we can purposely go out and try to improve our happiness. We can wake up in the morning and decide that we want to be happier. We just have to understand which actions are likely to make us happier and which ones aren't. And we're not necessarily good at recognizing that. And then, like I said before, once we decide to engage in those activities, similar to what Viktor Frankl said, we have to let go and not monitor it moment by moment, and we have to temper our expectations. But, you know, for people that are unhappy, there are things that many of us could do to increase our happiness, and we could approach those consciously.
Andrew, great stuff. Thank you very much for that. And by the way, this kind of puts me back in the direction of storytelling. It's almost like when Andrew says the quote of happiness is not something that you can pursue, it has to ensue. I think that applies to me when I get so focused on something that I would want and I think it'll make me happy. It's like, why can I not find contentment or satisfaction along the way of that? Why do I have to think that that's something to go get as opposed to something that can exist? We can find happiness at any state that we're in. And I'm not being Pollyanna, people have different circumstances, but it's almost like the storytelling that is so popular, Hannah, is all about like these big things and big goals and battles and wins and losses. And maybe it's just not as popular. Is there like more Ted Lasso wholesome storytelling in the folklore world that like doesn't prioritize all these big battles and really evil like bifurcated concepts and that kind of thing?
I mean, if we're talking about traditional folk tales in the sense that let's say like the Grimm brothers stories, no, there are no bright, cheery, happy endings, or I should say at least very few. There's much more, you know.
It's pretty dark too.
Incest and murder.
Okay,
and,
cool.
You know. Really dark, unhappy, deeply troubling things. I think we naturally crave a happy ending, but being preoccupied in the pursuit of a happy ending is quite a privilege. It's quite a thing. And this conversation is really interesting because it's a deeply personal thing and deeply contextual. And everything's relative, right? Which is, you know, one of the canned responses that I love to give to you, right? But
that happens to be true.
But it is true, right? And so, you know, you mentioned the house buying example. And I'll talk about myself for a second. I am extraordinarily privileged, as a 31-year-old to be trying to buy a house, right? And it's a terrible house. It's burned out. It's gutted. It's a mess, right? But I love this house and I would love to live there and have my own happy ending, right? But I also know that I have many, many peers who can't eke together a rent payment, you know, let alone call on some family help to buy a home, a cheap one, but still a home,
yeah.
Right? And you know, so I keep thinking, you know, yeah, it's so selfish of me to be worried about, you know, how we are going to repair the parquet flooring. You know, who cares? Who cares about parquet flooring?
Yeah, I mean, and honestly, like the battle's going to be if this house is for you. You know, it's like the Ted Lasso theme song says that I guess this might well be it. Like, we get to where we think we want to go, and we think it's going to make us happy. We look around and we kind of go, well, now what?
Right, exactly.
And that's okay to feel that
Absolutely.
Way. It's okay. We all struggle with that. This has been such a, I think, for me, an enlightening conversation. Hannah Davis, founding director of Flower City Folk, professor of practice in RIT School of Individualized Study. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Great having Jim Allen, professor of psychology at SUNY Geneseo, author of The Psychology of Happiness in the Modern World. Jim, a privilege to have you, sir. Thanks for making time.
Well, thanks for the opportunity, Evan. Thank you.
And back to Ted Lasso, Season 3. I'm going to go watch Episode 2 in about a minute. From Robin, Evan, and Julie and Megan, thanks for listening. We're back with you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.